Call the Judiciary Committee to order April 15th, 2011. We're going to start out in order today and have a public hearing on House Bill 2653. Open a public hearing. Staff?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2653 allows the Department of Revenue to collect judgments ordered by justice courts in criminal cases. It's filed at the request of the Interim Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Accountability for the Task Force on Effective and Cost-Efficient Service Provision.
We need Nancy, Representative Nevinson, can you come up, please? And might as well have Paul Snyder and the judge, Schlemhaus, come up with you, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee. I'm Nancy Nathanson, State Representative from District 13. The House will be hearing a number of bills that come from the Government Efficiency Task Force. This bill, 2653, is one of five that were assigned to the Judiciary Committee. As you may recall, that task force looked at a number of program areas where both the state and local governments and counties are delivering a service and have some shared responsibility. Recognizing the need to restructure the delivery of government services, representatives of state and local governments and organizations worked together to identify opportunities to fix problems, improve processes, eliminate burdensome procedures, and so forth. The ideas presented from that group improve efficiency, reduce cost, and in some cases also improve service. The task force approved nearly two dozen ideas for including in a report on final recommendations. Several are going to be accomplished through simply administrative actions, but a number of them require statutory language to enable them to come to fruition, and this is one of those that required a statutory change. It will allow counties to use a state service, bill collection, that they already use in a limited capacity, and for the state, since the work is self-funded because the department charges for using the service, it shouldn't be a negative impact for the state, but we would certainly be doing a favor for the counties that the counties have asked us to give them a hand in. It would be voluntary, not obligated. As the chair of the task force, I'm very happy to let you know that the task force unanimously supported forwarding this idea and the other bills that you will be hearing. I am happy to try to answer questions, but the other people with me know much more about the details of the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Mr. Snyder.
Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we support House Bill 2653, and I think Judge Schlemhaus can give the committee the details as to the need for the bill and the value that it would present both for the state and for justice courts.
Thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Judge Jad Schlemhaus, Justice of the Peace for Linn County. The advantages from 2653 for justice courts are fairly significant. I've outlined in some of the materials that I've submitted as written testimony a couple of letters that I've sent to one of the members of the committee as well as Representative Barnhart, outlining some of the concerns that justices of the peace face when trying to collect debt that are owed. And these are debts owed to the state of Oregon since justice courts are state courts. All of our judgments are entered in the name of the state of Oregon. And the state of Oregon benefits to this tune of 25 to as much as 50% of the revenue that we've collected in justice courts is paid to the state, depending upon the origin of the citations. Presently, I have about $1 million that is assigned to the Department of Revenue for collections, but I'm limited only to offset collections. And so of the million-plus dollars I collected in the year 2010, less than one-tenth of 1% was revenue that came from the Department of Revenue. Contrast that with the Oregon Judicial Department that in the fiscal year 2010 collected about 49.6% of all the revenue that it paid to the criminal fine and assessment account was paid to the from Department of Revenue full collections. And so there's a significant financial advantage for both the state and the counties by allowing the Department of Revenue to do full collections for justice courts. There's some peculiar problems that justices of the peace have in assigning judgments for collection to private collection agencies. Justice courts are somewhat unique in that the court is somewhat personal to the judge. The judge is the court executive for all purposes, and so if we assign a judgment to a collection agency, then the judge has a contractual relationship with the agency, privity of contract, so to speak, with the collection agency. That limits the ability of the judge to act in cases involving that collection agency, especially those cases where the agency is trying to enforce judgments that were entered by the court in a criminal action before the judge had actually entered the judgment. That's what's known as a clear conflict of interest. There's also a situation that arises when a collection agency files an action on a civil matter against a private party, when that agency is the agency to which the judge has assigned judgments in criminal actions for collections. That is also a clear conflict of interest. The judge in both of those cases is sitting in on a case that the judge has previously decided, where the opponent, so to speak, one of the adverse parties, is a party with whom the judge has an active contract. The other situation is an apparent conflict of interest where when judges assign judgments to collection agencies, that's generally a public fact. And then when a person comes before that judge on a small claim involving a collection agency, the person perceives the judge to be biased because it is known that this judge has contractual relationships with one or more collection agencies. And so we have two bases for the importance of this bill for justice courts. One is the financial advantage that it presents to both the state and the counties, and the other is the ethical problems that this particular bill will resolve. Right now, I do not assign judgments to collection agencies because I have a number of collection agencies that file civil actions in my courts. And so the only collection activities that I can undertake are those that are allowed by law. I'm fairly good at what I do. And so in fiscal year 2009, I collected about 91% of what I entered as judgments. In 2010, I collected about 94% of what I entered as judgments. This is a fairly high number. But nonetheless, I have $2.5 million in outstanding accounts receivable. If I had the assistance of the Department of Revenue for full collections, I could collect a much more substantial portion than 0.1% of my annual collections and then divide that between the state and the county. May I answer any questions?
Committee members, have any questions? I guess they're going to let you off easy.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to recess on 2653 for a minute and open up on House Bill 2925. Representative Halvey here. Have you... Representative testify, and then we're going to go back to the other one. That'll free you up. Prevailing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate that courtesy. State Representative Paul Holby, for the record, House District 8, which is Eugene, Lorraine, and Crow. I'm here to testify on House Bill 2925, which deals with protective orders for victims of domestic violence and sexual assault cases. You probably know that domestic violence fatalities have been increasing, and domestic violence instances have also been increasing at pretty alarming rates. Much of that, you know, for a lot of different reasons, I'm sure our economy doesn't help that situation. But it's just came to my attention working with some folks, Sybil Hebb. I really appreciate her hard work on this, and in my own community, looking at some issues around protective orders when in fact somebody is arrested and put in jail and is a defendant, that they actually will contact the victim. And our domestic violence victims at that point sometimes become intimidated and will change their stories or not testify and place themselves back in a dangerous situation because they get scared of the threats that sometimes come, and they're coming while the person is in jail. And so this bill's aimed at trying to stop some of that, and hopefully will, if your committee sees fit, we'll move the bill out. I think we've worked really hard on this bill and with a lot of the stakeholders trying to get the language correct and acceptable to most everyone that I'm aware of anyway at this point. So that's essentially what this bill is about. It's essentially just about trying to provide fill a hole where there should be a protective order, and certainly it will help, I think, the DAs be able to prosecute these cases a little bit better, because the people that are testifying aren't going to get scared out of testifying, and they're not going to then end up back in a relationship where they're subject to more potential abuse. So I appreciate your considering this, and I appreciate the courtesy to go ahead and do that now.
Okay. Committee members, do you have any questions for Representative Holtby? You must have convinced us.
Well, I'm sure there'll be some other testimony that will elaborate on some of the technical aspects that I'm probably not qualified to answer anyway. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairs, committee members, thank for your you. Attention.
Okay, we'll recess then, go back off of 2925 and go back for a public hearing on House Bill 2653. And Alex, is it Kyler? Kyler?
Thank you, Co-Chair Krieger, Co-Chair Barker, members of the committee. I'm Alex Kyler. I am the Intergovernmental Relations Manager for Lane County, here to speak in favor of House Bill 2653. I'm submitting some written testimony to the committee and an attached document that shows Lane County's experience back through July 2004 with collections at our justice courts. And you can see sort of a quarterly record here of what the collection rate has been. Hearing Judge Lemhouse speak about 91% collection rate is very encouraging. You can see ours has hovered in the mid to high 60s with an average over that time period of 63%. If you look on the very back of the page, the summary shows that over that time period, 63% recovery, an amount outstanding of total imposed fines of close to $30 million, an amount outstanding of almost $11 million. And I'll just summarize by suggesting that we've got a great relationship with a private collection firm. We do some of our own collections. Having an additional tool, even if it would only result in a slight increase in collections, would be significant for us, as our internal auditor, who was the one who initially turned me on to this issue, suggested that a small percent of a very large number is still a very large number. So we'd appreciate it if you pass the bill, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, committee? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Jim Markey, come up, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, a professional association of private collection agencies. I'm here to oppose this bill on their behalf. I just want to say, with respect to the issue of potential conflict of interest or alleged conflict of interest with a private collection agency collecting debts for a justice court, easily solved by simply issuing an RFP and indicating in the RFP that anybody that gets the collection effort can't file suits in the justice court they're collecting for. And I've got collection agencies be glad to do that. I've got collection agencies that don't use justice court. So that, to me, not a problem. We had a work group on this issue last year. It was attended by the people that have testified here today, including myself. Representative Olson was there, Representative Barnhart. I thought that we reached an agreement at that table that the justice courts were going to go out and find out what their receivables were, what their delinquencies were, what their collection rates were, and bring back that information so that we could all get together and assess how best to improve their collections. Coming in with and to say, well, gee, if we could just use the Department of Revenue, our problems will go away. We'll be able to collect our debts then, isn't really the answer. What we do in this building sometimes between government and private collection agencies, we argue about who the best person to collect a debt that's 10 years old is, and what we forget to do is start looking at the front end. And the way to collect this money is to have good account receivable management systems in place and follow the procedures. And through that mechanism, you'll find you can increase collections dramatically. I've had a committee that's worked with the judicial branch on this very thing, and we find that there are things you can do at the front end. So I would just say that this committee shouldn't be too quick to move in a direction without examining what the problem is and all of the solutions available. That I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions, committee?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. It sounds like, to your knowledge, you don't have access to any data, or there isn't maybe any data as to what the most effective approach is, whether it's Department of Collections or professional collectors. Is there data available?
To my knowledge, there's no data available in this area. And we have no data on what the receivables are of the 30 or so justice courts that we have in this state, what the age of the accounts is, or what the collection efforts are that have been undertaken. We don't have any information.
Anything further, committee? Representative Tomei.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have any data from other states?
I don't have any data from other states, no.
Okay, thank you, Jim.
Thank you.
Close a public hearing on House Bill 2653 and reopen House Bill 2925. And can we have Gail Meyer, Gina Skinner, and Sybil Hebb, please? Staff, will go ahead and describe the bill for us, please.
Chairs and members of the committee. House Bill 2925 requires the court to enter a no-contact order as to a victim against a defendant upon arraignment for domestic violence or sex crime, authorizes court at victim's request to enter additional order at sentencing for a period of time equal to statutory maximum sentence for the crime, authorizes victims to petition for termination of the order, declares an emergency effective on passage. There are amendments just received or still pending that are not yet summarized, but I believe the folks are able to testify about those, and there are copies at the dais, I believe, of the ones that are available.
Yeah.
That's my understanding.
Good afternoon, members of the committee, Co-Chair Barker and Co-Chair Krieger. My name is Gina Skinner, and I am representing the Oregon District Attorney Association on this bill. I'm here to testify regarding House Bill 2925 and specifically to the Dash 2 amendments. My understanding is you have received them recently, and in essence, they are replacing the entire bill that you already had. The language that is in the Dash 2 amendments was reflected in the first bill. We just wanted to simplify it significantly. And in essence, what this bill is going to be doing is, as you heard previously, closing a loophole that currently exists in the law. Currently, when somebody is arrested on a domestic violence crime and they are released from either the jail or they've been cited and released, it's mandated that the court put them on a release agreement. And one of the conditions that is required by law is that release agreement prohibit the offender from having contact with the victim. There is a provision that a victim can come to court and request that be modified, and there would be a hearing on that issue, and the judge would hear all sides and make a determination. But in the middle of the night, or whenever it is that the defendant is being arrested, it is mandated that the defendant be prohibited from contacting the victim. However, on a number of crimes of domestic violence and sexual assault, the defendant remains in custody. And currently, there is no provision under Oregon law that prohibits the defendant from contacting the victims of those crimes as long as they're in jail or in the Department of Corrections. And as a result, the defendants have a number of ways that they can access the victims. Most jails now have phone systems that are designed for the defendant to be able to contact the victim 24 hours a day. There's also the ability to mail letters and postcards from the jail. They also have the ability to have visitors that they can send messages through a third party that they can contact the victim. And the concern specifically for these crimes is that during this time, right after the defendant has been arrested, especially for the crimes where the defendant is remaining in custody, which most likely are the more serious crimes, the victims are in an extremely dangerous and vulnerable position. The defendant has an opportunity to do a number of things. They can threaten the victim, they can coerce the victim, or they can be more subtle and make promises or make the victims feel guilty for the fact that they're in custody, making comments about how they're not going to have any money or they're not going to have a house or a car or what about the children. And all of these things are designed to manipulate the victim into being less likely to be cooperative with the prosecution, to be able to testify truthfully at a grand jury proceeding or at trial, and so that the defendant ultimately is not going to be held accountable. And it's really just a tool in order to not ultimately be able to have the defendant be convicted of the crimes or be placed on treatment or receive the supervision that they desperately need. There is currently a law in Washington that already has this provision. It actually is a misdemeanor there, and on the third offense, it's actually a felony. In Oregon, what we are seeking as a penalty would be contempt of court, which is the maximum penalty is actually 6 months in jail. It's similar to a restraining order violation. The manner in which this bill suggests that this would occur is under one of two different ways. Either when a defendant meets with a release officer prior to arraignment and release is denied, then that release officer would have the ability statutorily now to put in place a no contact order that would remain in effect while the defendant was in custody. If there's a jurisdiction that doesn't have a release officer or the defendant does not meet with a release officer prior to arraignment, that arraignment must occur within 36 hours of the arrest, excluding weekends and holidays. When the defendant were to go in front of a judge that at the time of arraignment, then the judge would be mandated to put this no contact order again, which would remain in effect while the defendant was in custody. And in essence, throughout the remainder of the case, the no contact order would remain in effect while the defendant is in custody, and then that would stay in effect and or be replaced by a release agreement, which would continue that no contact order until the case was resolved one way or the other, unless, again, there's a provision in this bill, as there is a provision in the current statute, that would allow a victim to come to court and petition that be removed at the request, and the judge would have discretion to make a decision at that point. We anticipate that there will be testimony that is asking that this be discretionary and not be mandatory. There's a number of reasons why we feel that the language should be mandatory. The statutory scheme for domestic violence currently has many things in it that are mandatory, and that is for a reason. We all remember the days 25, 30 years ago before we had mandatory arrest. Police officers went out to a home and asked the victim, "Do you want the offender arrested?" And most likely they said no, and things continued. And most likely that was because they had been threatened, they had been coerced. I see Representative Olson probably had cases like that in his own career. But as a result, in an effort to create a much more a system that would have better results for finding the defendants accountable and for safety for the victims. It's now mandatory arrest. The current release agreement provision is mandatory, and so we would ask that this mirror that language. And again, there is a provision that would allow a review of that at the victim's request down the road. Again, it's likely that a victim could be manipulated with that initial decision being made. It would be inconsistent amongst perhaps judges or jurisdictions or defendants, and we would just ask that that would remain consistent. And so we strongly ask that this language be added to our statutory scheme so that we can provide safety and the ability to have freedom from the defendants and their coercion and their threats during this very vulnerable time. Thank you.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center to offer our support of House Bill 2925 with the Dash 2 amendments as well. Representative Holvey and Ms. Skinner have done a great job of outlining the issues in the bill. I have written testimony which does the same, as well as an outline of the Dash 2 amendments. I'll offer, in addition, that from the Law Center's perspective, and as you all know, we provide legal assistance to low-income Oregonians. Our mission is to help them achieve access to justice, making sure that victims of domestic and sexual violence have access to safety mechanisms that will allow them to achieve stability and safety for themselves and their children as they recover from in the aftermath of an assault are of the highest priority for us. This bill will help victims stay safe. It will also help to accomplish offender accountability. Those are two of the highest goals in looking at any domestic and sexual violence policies. We think the bill does a good job of accomplishing both, and it does it in a practical and narrowly targeted way, just to address the times when an offender is in custody after an arrest on these crimes, and helps to facilitate the prosecution of these crimes by reducing the manipulation and harassment of victims. And so our clients who suffer from these crimes, we hear from them about the phone calls that they get during this time period, and it has a great impact on their lives and their sense of security. So we appreciate the work that's gone into this and Representative Holvey's leadership and the committee's time. The only other thing I would add is that many statistics from many states and nationally indicate that criminal no-contact orders of this nature are a good tool and do provide important victim safety measures. So we hope the work can take this step.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We would agree that victims of domestic violence and sex crimes should be free of manipulation and threats by the offender who's been arrested. I do note, and what I think is a little bit odd about the posture of this bill, That is protected. That's a crime. Tampering with the witness is a C felony. Anyone who knowingly induces or attempts to induce a witness to either offer false testimony, to unlawfully withhold any testimony, or to be absent from an official proceeding commits a C felony. All phone calls from places of custody are recorded. Notes and postcards are read. And just on a logistical matter, phone calls are made on a collect. They're collect, and so someone would have to accept the charges. What we're talking about here is not really an issue of public safety of the offender being out of custody, but now we're talking about mandating conditions while they are in custody, and it bottom line comes down to two people communicating. There are those instances where a very strong, articulate woman, person, victim, wants to have some communication. Now, I understand that the bill here allows them to petition the court, but we think that the better calculation here is instead of mandating this in all instances, that you give the court the discretion to do it in the appropriate instance. We just think that's the better way to go. Thank you.
Questions?
Thank you. Ms. Skinner. The defense kind of touched on the tampering count, and if we pass this, somewhere out there a prosecutor is going to think, we get some of our best evidence from these recorded conversations and sometimes additional charges, and that goes into the overall approach to the case. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Co-chairs Barker and Krieger and members of the committee and Representative Hicks, it is an attractive thought. to think about the evidence that comes from those. It's a balancing test. First of all, this bill, a couple of things. First of all, this bill does not put any sort of mandates on the correctional facilities. They may or may not allow the phone systems to continue to work as they do currently. They may or may not employ any additional resources to monitoring this or doing anything to prevent it from occurring. Like many things, the onus will be on the defendant to have been told that you don't do this, and then they do it anyway. And then there would be repercussions for having done that. There's already, most jails have jail policies in existence that prohibit contact, and the contact occurs anyway. With limited resources, they just have no way to be able to limit that. Victims are they may change their phone number. They may defendants use other defendants' PIN numbers so that they can get around blocked numbers. They, you know, use third-party contact. They have their cellmate call them. I mean, there's a number of different ways that they can continue this contact, even with efforts for the jail to make it stop. They can write letters and postcards to their children who are 2 and 3 years old with all sorts of messages on them. And so ultimately, the responsibility is on the defendant to not to stop the manipulating behavior by trying to continue to contact the victim. Is regarding this, the tampering statute, I'm glad you mentioned that. As you just heard what the elements are, and I know that you're familiar with it, it is a very narrowly drafted statute, and it only applies in a circumstance if the defendant says the magic words of telling the victim, when you go to court, I want you to, you know, lie or to not provide all the truth about what happened, or if you've been summoned to court, I want you to not show up. And oftentimes they're very careful about what they say to just sort of dance around that issue in a number of different ways or just generally be manipulative or threatening or making them feel guilty without necessarily saying those words. And every once in a while we are able to prosecute somebody for tampering, but it is the rare circumstance that does occur. So it seems like whenever something, a roadblock is put up, a defendant will find a way to get around it. And so I have confidence that they will find a way to continue to seek out their victims and contact them, regardless of what we tell them or what other provisions are put into place. We would just like there to be a penalty for them when they do so. But thank you for your question.
Okay. Representative Juan.
Thank you, Mr. Kosher. Is there anything in the law right now that prevents a judge from issuing this type of a no-contact order for a defendant that's being held pending trial?
Currently? Yeah, Co-Chairman Krieger and Barker and members of the committee, Representative Wand, I am unaware of anything that currently exists that would authorize the defendant, or excuse me, authorize the judge to not allow contact during that time. There is a special statutory provision in the entire section, in the 135 section, that talks about release from custody, and that's where all the languages exist with the no contact provisions. But that could be corrected.
Follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what I'm really driving at here is, I just want to know, do we need this bill in order for a judge to be able to issue a no contact when someone's being held? I mean, do they not have plenary authority to do that or anything like that?
Co-Chairman Barker and Krieger and members of the committee, Representative Wand, I guess that a judge could order whatever the judge wanted to order, I would imagine. I don't want to speak out of turn, but the concept of this bill is to create, again, a consistency across the board that would occur automatically. Otherwise, we would have to have a hearing on every single case, which would take an exceedingly large amount of time. We'd have to call witnesses, that there would have to be some kind of a method to install that order in each case. And it might be in one case and not in a number of other cases.
Just a real quick follow-up. They couldn't do that at the arraignment? I don't do criminal law, but maybe Representative Hicks can help me with that.
You want to go ahead?
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Yeah, arraignments, in the current posture of the law, they could. However, arraignments are a very succinct affair. Basically, the person appears briefly before the judge, they're arraigned on the charge specifically, and then kind of sent back into the system. If without a release condition, then nothing more is said regarding the victim, typically. I don't even think it's a critical stage proceeding. The victim really isn't contemplated as part of that proceeding. It's solely focused on the defendant.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I may.
Yes.
And also, this is for the guy that's arrested at 4 o'clock on a Friday. He's not going to see a judge till Monday.
Yeah.
And they're not going to, you know, have a judge come down the middle of the night on the weekend to tell him don't call.
Representative Garrett, you have
Thank
a question?
Further?
If I could just interject, I do believe in answer to Representative Warren's question that a judge would have the authority to do it if the defendant were in front of him. He could say no phone calls, no contact. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. We have three more people that are signed up. Jane Downey, is it Downey? Aaron Grinwald and Rowessa Warren, please. Please state your names and go over who wants to go first.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, my name is Jane Downing, and I'm the executive director of Mid-Valley Women's Crisis Service, providing hope and safety to victims of domestic and sexual violence here in Marion County, and representing victims and survivors throughout the state through the programs that are working to help them. I just wanted to let you know that we help thousands of victims every year, and it is not uncommon for us to hear from those victims that they are having being contacted while their perpetrator is in the jail, and this is very disturbing for them. And I know it was suggested that they might not accept a call from their abuser, but it's not safe for them to not accept that call. It's been made very clear to them that you will answer my calls, you know you're going to listen to whatever I have to say, and that is very difficult for victims to be able to deal with that when they're in the midst of just having dealt with being abused. They're unsure of what's going to happen to them in the future, and they're unsure what's going to happen with their entire situation. And so having those threats continue, or the promises of this time it's going to be different, I'm going to change, everything's going to be okay, is extremely difficult for them to be able to have a situation where they can start to heal, start to think clearly about what decisions they want to make for themselves and their future, and very often for their children also. And those threats can include threats to those children that they're dealing with. I wanted to tell you just briefly about one situation we had. We had a young woman we were working with who had been sexually assaulted. When her perpetrator was in jail, he continued to call her over and over. And think about, you've been sexually assaulted, you've been terrorized by that individual, and then to have those calls continue to come in. I would just ask you to please consider passing this bill. That consistency of the no-contact order could be incredibly supportive to victims in the state of Oregon. And we appreciate your attention to this matter. And if you have any questions of programs like ours, I'm happy to answer them. So thank you very much for taking a look at this.
Thank you, co-chairs, members of the committee. My name is Aaron Greenwald. I'm the Domestic Violence Resource Prosecutor for the Oregon Department of Justice, testifying on behalf of the Department of Justice. And I would echo the sentiments by Ms. Downing, Ms. Hebb, and Ms. Skinner, all that they've testified about. And I'm sure all of you are aware and have heard testimony about how domestic violence is not just about physical abuse. It's also about emotional and verbal abuse. And so while it's the physical abuse that probably more often than not that has put the perpetrator in jail, it takes a different route once that person is behind bars. Then it becomes emotional, it becomes verbal, and as Ms. Skinner said, those first few hours, much like when a victim tries to leave a relationship, when that person has been locked up, that victim is still vulnerable and is very vulnerable to the coercion, to the threats, the cajoling that happens time in and time out. It is, as a prosecutor, I've been doing these cases for 13 years, it is the exception rather than the rule when these phone calls don't start automatically dramatically. And it's not always just the threats, I'm going to hurt you, but it's the promises that things are going to change. It's the promises that I love you and I'm going to take care of you if you just help me out. I would touch upon the tampering issue, and I would reiterate what Ms. Skinner said, which is that that is a very difficult charge. If we could charge it, we would charge it. It's just difficult to prove because those magic words have to be said. If this clarifying statute were put into place, then it would give prosecutors the opportunity not just to protect the integrity of our cases, but also to protect the victims from further victimization and to hold the offenders accountable, which is, I think, all of those things are important to prosecutors as we go forward. So I would urge the committee to go forward on this bill, and I thank you for your time.
Good afternoon. My name is Rosvita Tavorin, and I'm working with an agency in Eugene, with a domestic violence agency. I'm working as a against domestic violence advocate with parole and probation and also with Kids First, a forensic interview team in Lane County. I heard about this just briefly yesterday, really fast, and was asked to come. I do believe that this bill is really important due to the fact we as an agency say there is a window of opportunity right after the arrest for the victim to be able to move on with her life, but also not to be intimidated or threatened through those phone calls. And a lot of times those code words which are coming from the jails are not just blatant out threats, which can be really used as a prosecution piece in a lot of cases. If he says, you know, I have hope for our relationship to work out, it might convert to her into, okay, the last time he put the gun on the table and said, if you ever leave me, I will kill you. And so certain key words which are used through this phone call conversations are really not beneficial later on for the prosecution piece. So I definitely are for the bill. Thank you so much.
Committee members, do you have any questions, comments? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2925. The gavel is going to go over to Co-Chair Barker to work some bills.
Thank you. Open a work session on House Bill 2077.
Members of the Council. Committee, chairs. House Bill 2077 was previously heard on March the 23rd. There's no revenue impact and no fiscal. I'm sorry, both. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact. Make sure I'm on the right bill. With a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. This is the one that allows the Department of State Police to enter into real property transactions necessary for specialized services, declares an emergency effective on passage. There was concern about a provision in the bill that was sort of a broad grant of authority beyond the terms of the bill. That was removed in the Dash 3 amendments. The chair's primary concern was the ability to raise or institute fees of some kind based on the use of that broad scope of authority. So that's what the Dash 3s are meant to address by simply taking that provision out. The change in the law is that the Department of State Police currently doesn't have any authority to own the real property.
Mr. Chair, I move that we move the Dash 3s into House Bill 2077.
Representative Krieger moves Dash 3s into House Bill 2077. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2077 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2077 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Call. Is it without recommendation, Mr. Chair?
Yes, we could recommend. There was no recommendation. Yeah.
Thank you.
Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Whitman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Open a work session on House Bill 2708.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2708 was previously heard on March 15th and March 29th. It has no revenue impact, no fiscal impact, and a referral to Ways and Means. Protects consigner's artwork or consigner's portion of proceeds from sale from a creditor's claim against a consignee. Declares an emergency effective on passage. There is a dash one amendment that originated, I believe, from Representative Wand in cooperation with the Oregon Law Commission. It inserts a reference in to the art law provisions that are the subject of the measure into Oregon's Uniform Commercial Code. The bill comes from Oregon Law Commission in response to an opinion in a New York case that pointed out an error in Oregon law. The New York court reviewed existing laws in other states, and Oregon was among them, and discovered the error. And as written, Oregon's law protects an artist's work not only from a gallery's creditors, as intended, but from the artist's creditors as well. And this bill corrects that overprotection to allow an artist's creditors to reach the work to satisfy the artist's debt, but not a gallery's creditors to satisfy a gallery debt.
And the subsequent referral of Ways and Means has been rescinded on this one.
Forgive me, that's correct. There was a permission letter in the file previously obtained. The subsequent referral to Ways and Means was, depending on whether or not there was a fiscal impact, and since there isn't one, we got permission to remove the subsequent referral.
Okay, is any discussion about this bill? Everybody remember this one?
Dash ones? Yeah. Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash ones into House Bill 2708.
Representative Krieger moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2708. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2708 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2708 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shopler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wizen.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye.
Motion carries. Who would like to carry that bill? Representative Wong, thank you. And open a work session on House Bill. We'll jump out of sequence here and move an opening work session on House Bill 3166.
Mr. Chair, chairs and members of the committee, House Bill 3166 is the bill that bars filings of requests for review of land use decisions or limited land use decisions with the Land Use Board of Appeals 10 years after the date of the decision. It was previously heard on March 22nd. It has no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact. There are two amendments, a dash one and a dash two. The dash one changes the prohibition from 10 years to 5. The dash two changes the prohibition from 10 years to 6. It is currently possible for a party who adheres to the land use permitting process and complies with its requirements to be appealed decades after receiving a decision through no fault of their own and long after they've relied on the decision that is later the subject of an appeal. This bill puts a limit of number of years.
Mr. Co-Chair, there was an indication that we wanted to go with the dash twos, so I want to move the dash twos.
Okay, Representative Krieger moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 3166.
So how many years would that make?
Six.
And why are we doing that instead of five? Is there a reason? I'd go with three.
We knew that there was some discomfort getting below five or five or below. Representative Garrett had offered the compromise at six.
All right, Mr. Chair, thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Tomei.
No, that's the same thing.
Great time. Thank you.
We are trying to accommodate in a bipartisan way. All emotions and feelings.
Mr. Co-Chair.
President Wong.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I might also add that this is a 6 years is a very common statute of limitations in the practice, so it makes it easier for practitioners as well. There's several things that have a 6-year statute of limitations under the law.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Krieger moves the dash twos in House Bill 3166. Any further discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, so ordered.
Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 3166 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 3166 to the floor as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Aye.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shopler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Woodman.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hicks.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Representative Garrett, would you carry that for us?
Freeman.
Okay, we'll have Representative Freeman carry the bill. Thank you.
Wow, saved you.
I'll sit next to him. Open a hearing on House Bill 2710, work session, I'm sorry, on House Bill 2710. And we're going to have testimony on this bill. Council?
At the chair's discretion, the chair and members of the committee, there are folks here who would like to supplement the record because even though it's made some, the House Bill 2710 has made some progress since its prior hearing, there are issues that remain, but the many of the stakeholders agree that those issues could be resolved in the next committee if the committee is so inclined. There are folks here from the State Bar, Susan Gravy, there's Mr. Snyder from Association of Counties, Elizabeth Cushwa in particular pointed out a conceptual agreement that wasn't represented in the amendments that are available to the members, and she'd like to make a record on that. And Mr. Hendricks is also here from Legislative Council to discuss her issues.
Okay, if the first three people would come up.
Could I ask staff a question?
Yeah.
And thank you, Mr. Chair, for staff. Could we just confirm this is a 3/5 chamber vote to pass? Is
That's
this a 3/5?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Chair, some members of the committee, Representative Nolan, he was asking if it was a 3/5 vote to pass.
Chair, I just wanted to let people realize that this was not an easy assignment during the interim back committee. I really appreciate the work of the work group and the time that they spent, because if it hadn't been for our staff, it hadn't been for Andy Olson and Susan Gravy and everybody else that was there, we wouldn't be where we are. And Representative Garrett, I understand, even had a little something to do with it. So I just think we need to
still
understand.
Still a good bill.
I think we've got it as good as we can for now, and we can be looking at it again in February or next session if we don't think we got it totally right.
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, members of the committee, thank you. For the record, my name is Susan Gravy with the Oregon State Bar, and want to say, echo the words of Chair Krieger, this has been a long work group, a long effort. A lot of people have worked very hard to reach a consensus. There are a few remaining issues on this bill, but I think in general, the Dash 6 amendments are good amendments, and we need to move forward with the bill. We've presented some written testimony that you can take to add to the list to refine further definition of court facilities and some other things within the bill. And I know there are a few other things that other members of the work group have raised and outside the work group, and we hope to address those in the next committee. At this point, I would say simply that we support it. We appreciate all the efforts of the work group members, Representative Olson and Representative Garrett, support from the co-chairs, and urge you pass the amendment and the bill.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties, and we also support House Bill 2710 with the Dash 6 amendments, and we also very much appreciate the work of the work group, and in particular Representatives Olson and Garrett. We did have an issue that we raised with the work group. It may be resolved. It has to do with Justice Court filing fees and the discrepancy that would arise between circuit court filing fees and justice court filing fees for cases where they have concurrent jurisdiction. In other words, a claimant or a petitioner or a party could file in either court. And the issue was, first of all, to cover the cost of litigating these cases in the justice court with the fees that are provided. The other is to avoid forum shopping as much as possible so that people don't move en masse from circuit court to justice court and then deluge those smaller courts with these cases. This may be resolved by the amendments in the bill, and we're more than happy to wait and see. But if for some reason they're not, we'd like to be able to come back to you in another legislative session and offer further changes.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, co-chairs, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Elizabeth Cushwa, representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. The district attorneys are responsible for 26 counties worth of child support enforcement. And we discovered about 6 weeks ago that when the bill was drafted, it maintained the exemption for the Department of Justice child support programs for the filing fees exemption. It removed the section for the civil child support enforcement for the counties. for those offices. So when dealing with paternities, motions, contempts, registrations for orders, the counties would all be on the hook for the child support enforcement activities for this. We brought this up with Representatives Garrett and Olson, who were very happy to entertain it. We had consensus, conceptual agreement from everybody. For some reason, it just didn't manage to make it into the amendment. I know there's some question as to whether it may or may not apply. I just like to be able, no intention of holding the bill up, but it's very important that we address this in the next committee, and I think there's full agreement to do that. So I just wanted to set the record, and I thank you, and especially Representatives Garrett and Olson for their time. It's amazing they have any hair left. Thanks.
Thank you very much, panel. Mr. Hendricks, do you want to add anything? Or? Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Representative Westnap.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. First, for our council, would it be possible and too much work when we to put next to each of the fees what the old amount was? That would really, in your staff summary, Mr. Ross, even the, you know, to put. Would that be too much work, or is that possible?
Chair, members of the committee, Representative Quisnet, I believe I can do that.
Thank you.
If they correspond, the way it's been restructured with the uniform schedule, it may not be, but I can try.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Snyder, House General Government passed out a bill about the law libraries, and on the floor of the House, it was concerned there was a question about whether 2710 was going to allow the counties to keep that same amount of money to do other things, or can you address the fees or how they're going to go to the law libraries, and is that money then at the discretionary of the counties to put in other expenses?
Co-Chair Barker, Co-Chair Krieger, Representative Wisnett, the fees would be modified by House Bill 2710. The authority in the other bill that passed on the House floor yesterday, I believe, there would have to be conflict amendments because I think they treat the same ORS section differently, but I don't think there's broad disagreement. Maybe there's not any disagreement as to how that authority should be expanded in terms of providing law library services as well as providing law library facilities. I think there's not an issue there.
Thank you. Ms. Snyder, maybe I would suggest maybe, because I think the intent, there are a lot of people are concerned that maybe we want to give the county's authority to move that money and it may not be there. So can you look at that in the Senate to see if that needs to be addressed in the other bill, please?
Yes, sir, I will.
Thank you.
Representative
Tomei.
Thank you. I'm just wondering, which this says 2710 is amended. Is that with the Dash 6 amendment?
That's correct.
Thank you.
Chair, some members of the committee, there are a couple of flowcharts, one put together by LFO from the interim committee data, and one sort of cobbled together by House Judiciary staff for today's discussion purposes.
Thank you. That's great.
Thank you. Anything further? Okay, thank you, panel.
Thank you.
Now, Mr. Hendricks, we'll try it again.
Chair Barker, Chair Krieger, members of the committee, Dave Hendricks from the Legislative Council's office. One other little tweak that we need to do, it can be done. I understand this is going to go over to another committee. On page 4, we need to delete line 22. We currently have two different fees in the bill for forcible entry and detainers, and it just pointed out to me in the hall. So we do definitely need to do one more set of amendments on this at some point. But I've got a list. So if anybody has any questions on the bill, I'd be happy to try to answer.
Any questions for Mr. Henry?
How's he spell his name?
Yeah. Thank you.
Was there anybody else that need to speak on this today? Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 2710.
Representative Krieger moves the Dash 6 amendments into House Bill 2710. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection?
If I may interrupt, chairs and members of the committee, the Dash 3s, which are a separate amendment that do not incorporate any of the other amendments, it's a standalone amendment that is for declaratory judgments. It's a an omission, a fix, a technical adjustment, and the need be passed separately by itself if the committee was so inclined. And that was previously agreed to and omitted from the joint interim committee's draft of 2710.
So it's a separate.
Correct. That's what
so
I'm saying.
So we put in the six now and then the three.
You would have to pass both the six and the three, correct? And
There's a question.
Does this relate to the bill that we just heard last week regarding declaratory judgments?
I apologize.
You might not have been on that particular bill. Okay. I think it does. Yes, that bill.
Which we haven't moved.
Which we haven't moved. That's right. I think he's going to come back with an amendment. So I wanted to, before we go moving that one in, we should think about the way ahead. Do we want to do it this way, or do we want to wait for him to come back with his amendment on that other bill?
My suggestion would be we go ahead and move this, and we can watch as this is going to another committee for further adjustment.
Okay.
So.
I'm okay with that.
Move the.
We haven't finished yet.
Yeah,
so we have a Representative Krieger moves the dash sixes into 2710. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so now the dash three.
Okay, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the dash threes into House Bill 2710.
Representative Krieger moves the dash three amendments into House Bill 2710. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House Bill 2710 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2710 as amended to the Ways and Means Committee. Is there any discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And perhaps Representative Olson or Garrett. So this measure is estimated to generate $86.7 million in revenue. Is that an increase, decrease, or at the same as the previous biennium, if you happen to know that? In the aggregate.
Well, that's a good question. It's not as easy to answer as I think, because the intent of this amendment is to retain the same level of funding through civil fees that we have currently by virtue of House Bill 2287 that was passed last year, which was a bill to temporarily increase fees to help the Judicial Department bridge a deficit. So I believe we have revenue neutrality, assuming the continuation of that bill. Does that make sense?
Mr. Co-Chair, yeah, it does. It sounds, though, during the interim, there was a fee increase authorized. Is that accurate? We're having revenue neutrality with that? No.
It wasn't during the interim. It was in the 2009 session. We raised fees through House Bill 2287.
Okay.
Taking that new benchmark, this bill remains neutral to that benchmark.
To the 09-11
correct
standard. Okay. And so basically what we're doing here is sort of thank you. So we're sort of rearranging certain streams within the overall court filing fees structure, but that's going to be the same as where it was before. Thanks. Okay.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Representative Wisnant.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mrs. Ross, does that negate my request to you? I mean, if it's the same.
Well, many individual fees are different, but it nets out to revenue neutral.
Thank you. I still want to put work on it.
Would you still want to see the numbers side by side?
If it's a convenient, yes.
Okay. Yes.
I too would benefit from that, and seemingly destined to see the bill again. So what I am going to approve of here today is the overall revenue neutral number going forward to Ways and Means for further examination. But for anybody out there who have been sort of reiterating that I'm not going to raise, that I'm very concerned about raising fees along the way, we do need to keep that discussion going in the next stage of this bill. So I do approve the bill of moving into the next stage of the process as appropriate, but we do need to keep talking about this matter. Thank you.
Further discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Nolan.
Yes.
Representative Olson.
Aye.
Representative Shoffler.
Aye.
Representative Tomei.
Aye.
Representative Wong.
Aye.
Representative Wisnant.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Hitt.
Aye.
Co-Vice Chair Garrett.
Aye.
Co-Chair Krieger.
Aye.
Co-Chair Barker.
Aye. Motion carries. Bills moved down to Ways and Means. Further business. Adjourned.